Chapter 90. Accepted the pious frog with the maddest enthusiasm, and Bryam's power was sealed and secured for all time. Within 5 years afterward, he openly added polygamy to the tenets of the church by authority of a revelation which he pretended had been received 9 years before by Joseph Smith, albeit Joseph is amply on record as denouncing polygamy to the day of his death. Now was Bryam become a second Andrew Johnson in the small beginning and steady progress of his official grandeur. He had served successively as a disciple in the ranks, home missionary, foreign missionary, editor and publisher, apostle, president of the Board of Apostles, president of all Mormondom, civil and ecclesiastical, successor to the great Joseph by the will of heaven, prophet, seer, revelator. There was but one dignity higher which he could aspire to, and he reached out modestly and took that he proclaimed himself a god. He claims that he is to have a heaven of his own hereafter, and that he will be its god, and his wives and children its goddesses, princes, and princesses. Into it all faithful Mormons will be admitted, with their families, and will take rank and consequence according to the number of their wives and children. If a disciple dies before he has had time to accumulate enough wives and children to enable him to be respectable in the next world, any friend can marry a few wives and raise a few children for him after he is dead, and they are duly credited to his account, and his heavenly status advanced accordingly. Let it be borne in mind that the majority of the Mormons have always been ignorant, simple, of an inferior order of intellect, unacquainted with the world and its ways, and let it be borne in mind that the wives of these Mormons are necessarily after the same pattern, and their children likely to be fit representatives of such a conjunction. And then let it be remembered that for 40 years these creatures have been driven, relentlessly, and mobbed, beaten, and shot down, cursed, despised, expatriated, banished to a remote desert, whither they journeyed gaunt with famine and disease, disturbing the ancient solitudes with their lamentations, and marking the long way with graves of their dead, and all because they were simply trying to live and worship God in the way which they believed with all their hearts and souls to be the true one. Let all these things be borne in mind, and then it will not be hard to account for the deathless hatred which the Mormons bear our people and our government. That hatred has et fat its ancient grudge ever since Mormon Utah developed into a self-supporting realm, and the church waxed rich and strong. Bryam, as territorial governor, made it plain that Mormondom was for the Mormons. The United States tried to rectify all that by appointing territorial officers from New England and other anti-Mormon localities, but Bryam prepared to make their entrance into his dominions difficult. 3,000 United States troops had to go across the plains and put these gentlemen in office. And after they were in office, they were as helpless as so many stone images. They made laws which nobody minded, and which could not be executed. The federal judges opened court in a land filled with crime and violence, and sat as holiday spectacles for insolent crowds to gape at, for there was nothing to try, nothing to do, nothing on the dockets. And if a Gentile brought a suit, the Mormon jury would do just as it pleased about bringing in a verdict, and when the judgment of the court was rendered, no Mormon cared for it, and no officer could execute it. Our presidents shipped one cargo of officials after another to Utah, but the result was always the same. They sat in a blight for while they fairly feasted on scowls and insults day by day. They saw every attempt to do their official duties find its reward in darker and darker looks, and in secret threats and warnings of a more and more dismal nature, and at last they either succumbed and became despised tools and toys of the Mormons, or got scared and discomforted beyond all endurance and left the territory. If a brave officer kept on courageously till his pluck was proven, some pliant Buchanan or Pierce would remove him and appoint a stick in his place. In 1857, General Harney came very near being appointed governor of Utah. And so it came very near being Army Governor and Kradlbaugh Judge. Two men who never had any idea of fear further than the sort of murky comprehension of it which they were enabled to gather from the dictionary. Simply, if for nothing else, for the variety they would have made in a rather monotonous history of federal servility and helplessness, it is a pity they were not fated to hold office together in Utah. Up to the date of our visit to Utah, such had been the territorial record. The territorial government established there had been a hopeless failure, and Brigham Young was the only real power in the land. He was an absolute monarch, a monarch who defied our president, a monarch who laughed at our armies when they camped about his capital, a monarch who received without emotion the news that the August Congress of the United States had enacted a solemn law against polygamy, and then went forth calmly and married 25 or 30 more wives. Be the Mountain Meadows Massacre. The persecutions which the Mormons suffered so long and which they consider they still suffer in not being allowed to govern themselves, they have endeavored, and are still endeavoring, to repay. The now almost forgotten Mountain Meadows Massacre was their work. It was very famous in its day. The whole United States rang with its horrors. A few items will refresh the reader's memory. A great emigrant train from Missouri and Arkansas passed through Salt Lake City, and a few disaffected Mormons joined it for the sake of the strong protection it afforded for their escape. In that matter lay sufficient cause for hot retaliation by the Mormon chiefs. Besides, these 145 or 150 unsuspecting emigrants being in part from Arkansas, where a noted Mormon missionary had lately been killed, and in part from Missouri, a state remembered with execrations as a bitter persecutor of the saints, when they were few and poor and friendless, here were substantial additional grounds for lack of love for these wayfarers. And finally, this train was rich, very rich in cattle, horses, mules and other property, and how could the Mormons consistently keep up their coveted resemblance to the Israelitish tribes, and not seize the spoil of an enemy, when the Lord had so manifestly delivered it into their hand? Wherefore, according to Mrs. 105. Waite's entertaining book, The Mormon Prophet, it transpired that a revelation from Brigham Young, as great grand archer God, was dispatched to President J. 108, Bishop Higbee and J. D. Lee, adopted son of Brigham, commanding them to raise all the forces they could muster and trust, follow those cursed Gentiles, so read the revelation, attack them disguised as Indians, and with the arrows of the Almighty make a clean sweep of them, and leave none to tell the tale, and if they needed any assistance they were commanded to hire the Indians as their allies, promising them a share of the booty. They were to be neither slothful nor negligent in their duty, and to be punctual in sending the teams back to him before winter set in, for this was the mandate of Almighty God. The command of the revelation was faithfully obeyed. A large party of Mormons, painted and tricked out as Indians, overtook the train of emigrant wagons some 300 miles south of Salt Lake City, and made an attack. But the emigrants threw up earthworks, made fortresses of their wagons, and defended themselves gallantly and successfully for 5 days. Your Miss Sourire Arkansas gentleman is not much afraid of the sort of scurvy apologies for Indians which the southern part of Utah affords. He would stand up and fight 500 of them. At the end of the 5 days the Mormons tried military strategy. They retired to the upper end of the Edos, resumed civilized apparel, washed off their paint, and then, heavily armed, drove down in wagons to the beleaguered emigrants, bearing a flag of truce. When the emigrants saw white men coming they threw down their guns, and welcomed them with cheer after cheer. And, all unconscious of the poetry of it, no doubt, they lifted a little child aloft, dressed in white, in answer to the flag of truce. The leaders of the timely white deliverers were President Haight and Bishop John D. Lee, of the Mormon Church. Mr. Cradlibaugh, who served a term as a federal judge in Utah, and afterward was sent to Congress from Nevada, tells in a speech delivered in Congress how these leaders next proceeded. They professed to be on good terms with the Indians, and represented them as being very mad. They also proposed to intercede and settle the matter with the Indians. After several hours' parley, they, having apparently visited the Indians, gave the ultimatum of the savages, which was that the immigrants should march out of their camp, leaving everything behind them, even their guns. It was promised by the Mormon bishops that they would bring a force and guard the immigrants back to the settlements. The terms were agreed to, the immigrants being desirous of saving the lives of their families. The Mormons retired, and subsequently appeared with 30 or 40 armed men. The immigrants were marched out, the women and children in front and the men behind, the Mormon guard being in the rear. When they had marched in this way about a mile, at a given signal the slaughter commenced. The men were almost all shot down at the first fire from the guard. Two only escaped, who fled to the desert, and were followed 150 miles, before they were overtaken and slaughtered. The women and children ran on, 200 or 300 yards further, when they were overtaken, and with the aid of the Indians they were slaughtered. 17 individuals only, of all the immigrant party, were spared, and they were little children, the eldest of them being only 7 years old. Thus, on the 10th day of September, 1857, was consummated one of the most cruel, cowardly and bloody murders known in our history. The number of persons butchered by the Mormons on this occasion was 120. With unheard of temerity, Judge Cradlibaugh opened his court and proceeded to make Mormondom answer for the massacre. And what a spectacle it must have been to see this grim veteran, solitary and alone in his pride and his pluck, glowering down on his Mormon jury and Mormon auditory, deriding them by turns, and by turns reaffing threatenings and slaughter. An editorial in the Territorial Enterprise of that day says of him, and of the occasion, "He spoke and acted with the fearlessness and resolution of a Jackson. But the jury failed to indict, or even report on the charges, while threats of violence were heard in every quarter, and an attack on the U.S.S. troops intimated, if he persisted in his course. Finding that nothing could be done with the juries, they were discharged with a scathing rebuke from the judge. And then, sitting as a committing magistrate, he commenced his task alone. He examined witnesses, made arrests in every quarter, and created a consternation in the camps of the saints greater than any they had ever witnessed before, since Mormondom was born. At last accounts terrified elders and bishops were decamping to save their necks, and developments of the most startling character were being made, implicating the highest church dignitaries in the many murders and robberies committed upon the Gentiles during the past 8 years. Had Harney been governor, Cradlibaugh would have been supported in his work, and the absolute proofs adduced by him of Mormon guilt in this massacre, and in a number of previous murders, would have conferred gratuitous coffins upon certain citizens, together with occasion to use them. But Cumming was the federal governor, and he, under a curious pretense of impartiality, sought to screen the Mormons from the demands of justice. On one occasion he even went so far as to publish his protest against the use of the U.S.S. troops in aid of Cradlibaugh's proceedings. Mrs. 105. Waite closes her interesting detail of the great massacre with the following remark and accompanying summary of the testimony, and the summary is concise, accurate and reliable. For the benefit of those who may still be disposed to doubt the guilt of Young and his Mormons in this transaction, the testimony is here collated and circumstances given which go not merely to implicate, but to fasten conviction upon them by confirmation strong as proofs of Holy Writ. 1. The evidence of Mormons themselves, engaged in the affair, as shown by the statements of Judge Cradlibaugh and Deputy U.S.S. Marshal Rogers. 2. the failure of Brigham Young to embody any account of it in his report as Superintendent of Indian Affairs. Also his failure to make any allusion to it whatever from the pulpit, until several years after the occurrence. 3. The flight to the mountains of men high in authority in the Mormon Church and State, when this affair was brought to the ordeal of a judicial investigation. 4. The failure of the Deseret News, the church organ, and the only paper then published in the territory, to notice the massacre until several months afterward, and then only to deny that Mormons were engaged in it. 5. The testimony of the children saved from the massacre. 6. The children and the property of the emigrants found in possession of the Mormons, and that possession traced back to the very day after the massacre. 7. The statements of Indians in the neighborhood of the scene of the massacre. These statements are shown, not only by Cradlebaugh and Rogers, but by a number of military officers, and by J. Forney, who was, in 1859, Superintendent of Indian Affairs for the territory. To all these were such statements freely and frequently made by the Indians. 8. The testimony of R. P. Campbell, Captain 2D Dragoons, who was sent in the spring of 1859 to Santa Clara, to protect travelers on the road to California, and to inquire into Indian depredations. See concerning a frightful assassination, that was never consummated. If ever there was a harmless man, it is Conrad Wiegand, of Gold Hill, Nevada. If ever there was a gentle spirit that thought itself unfired gunpowder and latent ruin, it is Conrad Wiegand. If ever there was an oyster that fancied itself a whale, or a jack-o'-lantern, confined to a swamp, that fancied itself a planet with a billion-mile orbit, or a summer zephyr that deemed itself a hurricane, it is Conrad Wiegand. Therefore, what wonder is it that, when he says a thing, he thinks the world listens, that when he does a thing the world stands still to look, and that when he suffers, there is a convulsion of nature? When I met Conrad, he was upper intendant of the Gold Hill Assay Office, and he was not only its superintendent, but its entire force. And he was a street preacher too, with a mongrel religion of his own invention, whereby he expected to regenerate the universe. This was years ago. Here latterly he has entered journalism, and his journalism is what it might be expected to be. Colossal to ear, but pygmy to the eye. It is extravagant grandiloquence confined to a newspaper about the size of a double-letter sheet. He doubtless edits, sets the type, and prints his paper, all alone, but he delights to speak of the concern, as if it occupies a block, and employs 1,000 men. Something less than 2 years ago, Conrad assailed several people mercilessly in his little Eopold's Tribune, and got himself into trouble. Straightway he airs the affair in the Editorial Enterprise, in a communication over his own signature, and I propose to reproduce it here, in all its native simplicity and more than human candor. Long as it is well worth reading, for it is the richest specimen of journalistic literature the history of America can furnish, perhaps. From the Territorial Enterprise, January 20, 1870. Seeming plot for assassination miscarried. To the editor of the Enterprise. Months ago, when Mr. Sutro incidentally exposed mining management on the Comstock, and among others, roused me to protest against its continuance, in great kindness he warned me that any attempt by publications, by public meetings, and by legislative action, aimed at the correction of chronic mining evils in Story County, must entail upon me a. business ruin, b. the burden of all its costs, c. personal violence, and if my purpose were persisted in, then d. assassination, and after all nothing would be effected. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.